I've even got a new impression for you.
Okay, what you got?
I'm not going to tell you yet.
I have to wait for the new impression?
You got to wait for the new impression.
Did you come up with this somewhere in Vegas and Denver?
Nope, nope. It just, I can only do it for another day or two.
Okay.
You want a little taste?
Yeah, sure.
All right, ready? Here it is? Yeah. Here it is. Didgeridoo, right?
Yeah. Huh? Why can you only do that for one day?
Because I'm sick. My voice is all messed up.
Oh, I see.
Although it's suspiciously similar to Sylvester Stallone. Yeah. So it is not Tuesday. Your ears are not deceiving you. It is Thursday today. Post-election.
You had to bring that up, didn't you?
Where the Dems got creamed.
Yeah. While you were in D.C.
While I was in D.C.,
did you feel any pain or joy from the people around you?
No.
I remember my sister mentioning once that when George W. Bush won and all, because, you know, when there's a big shift in like the presidential thing, it's like a whole new set of people come in and a whole new set of people leave, you know?
Right.
And she's like, I never saw so many furs and cowboy boots in my entire life.
Wow.
Yeah.
Furs and cowboy boots.
Furs and cowboy boots. Yeah.
So it is Thursday, and this is on Taking Pictures, and we're going to talk about photography because we do that every week. We talk about creativity and photography and stuff like that. I apologize for my stuffed up sound. I got a little sick when I was away. We'll talk about that in a minute. But my name is Jeffrey Sidoris, and with me, the fancy New York portrait photographer, Bill Wadman.
Hey, Jeffrey. Welcome back.
We got to meet up finally.
Yeah, we did. Did we get any good pictures of us? Did anybody take pictures of us?
You know, we completely failed and did not get a group shot.
Yeah, we did. We didn't do that.
That was an epic fail.
So this all started, whatever it was, a month and a half ago when I was down there for a shoot, and I noticed at the Philadelphia Museum that there was a Paul Strand exhibit opening towards the end of October.
Yes.
And I think it was Chris Connors who was just like, let's put a group together and go see the show. So he put out a little invite on there, and you decided you were going to come out to the East Coast.
Yep.
And so we all met up in Philly on Sunday.
And it was terrific. And Chris, thank you so much for organizing this. And thank you to everyone who came out. It was such a great time. It's such a really terrific time.
You were a little overwhelmed by that museum.
I was a little overwhelmed by the entire trip.
Yeah.
I wasn't prepared for all the things that I saw and experienced at all. And then I got sick, which was kind of fun.
Well, we'll get to the sick in a minute.
Yeah. So it started out with Federal Donuts. That's where we met up.
Yeah. What'd you think of the donut?
I think Pips has nothing to worry about.
Okay.
Portland.
I'm going to have to go back to Portland and have it. But it was a pretty good donut, better. Right?
It's not bad.
Okay.
It's not bad.
All right.
Their coffee wasn't that great at all.
Okay. I don't drink coffee, so I don't know about that.
You didn't miss much there, mister.
Okay.
But they were pretty good. They were pretty good. And then we made our way to the museum, which is a stunning museum, beautiful museum.
Mm-hmm. Iconic.
Yeah, really, really terrific.
Yep.
And although I will say, in my opinion, and we'll get to this in a little more detail, but the Strand exhibit, while impressive, I think too big. I think there were too many pieces.
Yeah, there were. There was, 250, 260
something
prints?
Like that.
Yeah, and so like that. From what I understand, the Philadelphia Museum owns the Strand Archives.
Mm-hmm.
Which is where this all came from. Because a lot of times when you see a photographer show at some museum, it's a traveling exhibition that's moving from place to place. You know, it'll be in Philly today, Baltimore tomorrow, and San Francisco next year, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
Where this one apparently originated at the Philly Museum because they have his archives and they were going through them. And I think that overwhelming collection that they had sort of invited them to go too far. You know what I mean? Like, if you have all this, how often do we ever get to show it? Let's show it. I think that's kind of the sentiment that probably was going on.
It sure seemed like it.
Yeah.
But I'll tell you, by the end, Okay, here for me, there were a lot of pieces that felt like they were being forced on the viewer because they were part of the Strand collection.
Okay.
You know, like taken out of context, the photos are okay.
Yeah.
But because they're part of this larger whole, they're somehow elevated along with it.
But okay.
And you could probably say that about a number of exhibitions.
That's what I was going to say.
Exhibitions.
I think that that is true of most artists, you know, like some classic one, take Picasso, you know, there are the 15 or 20 Picasso pieces that are epic and monumental and the ones that really changed things. And then there are a whole lot around them that are similar or leading up to or post that or when he was bored or, you know, that kind of thing.
Right.
And I think the same is true of photography. It's like when a few of us got together and saw the Winogrand exhibit at the Met. It was the same way. It was like four rooms or five rooms of Winogrand photos on the walls, big rooms. And at a certain point, it's like, you know, there are the 20, 25 that are the iconic Paul Strand pictures or the iconic Winogrand pictures, you know, the iconic Avedon pictures. And then there's a lot of other pictures that are taken by Winogrand or Avedon or Strand that are neat, but not, you're not going to remember them tomorrow.
Right.
You know?
Right. And that's exactly how I felt about it. You know, in contrast, the National Portrait Gallery had a Josef Karsch exhibit.
Right.
And it was closing. I was lucky enough to see it. It was closing the next day. And it was maybe 30 pieces. Mm-hmm. And it was perfect.
Yes.
You go up the hallway one side, you come down the hallway the other side, and it was a great size. There were some that I'd seen before, some that I hadn't seen before.
Yep.
But every one of them was just a terrific shot.
Yeah. 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 And that's a different way of doing it, right? That's not, I mean, when they're doing like a big retrospective or something like that, it tends to be, you know, too many notes.
to borrow from Amadeus. Sure. Yeah.
And I think that the one thing I will say about the Strand stuff that I hadn't realized that I now realize is the huge arc of time that he was working in, you know, all the way from right after the turn of the century to the 1950s and 60s, you know.
Right, right.
And how different, I mean, he was taking pictures of horse carts in the street in New York City.
Right.
In 1910 or whatever it was. And then, you know, going all the way to some of those portraits in Italy that were in the 1950s and 60s, which is like after World War II, you know.
Right.
He was before World War I until after World War II. And the look of things, in the beginning he was shooting on those little glass plates that he had to get internegatives and then blown up to larger things to make platinum contact prints, you know, that we remember all that whole case that you and I were talking about.
Yeah, and in fact, I'd love to go over that.
Sure.
Because you hit on something. He saw, and we as the viewer are allowed to see, the technology of photography change in his lifetime.
Yes.
And things contrast. The ability to get dynamic range changed.
Yep.
The ability to print in ways that he couldn't have before.
Yep.
And you just hit on something. The way he had to make internegatives to make prints. Talk about that for a minute.
Yeah. So he was shooting with, I forget the name of the camera and somebody's going to yell at me because I'm sure they noticed. He was shooting with this camera that shot basically a 2x3-inch glass plate.
Mm-hmm.
But the prints that he was making are platinum prints, which are made as contact prints. So what you do is you sit the glass plate on top of a sheet of paper that you've made sensitized with the salts and the platinum. And you know, you expose it to light, and then you run it through the chem. But you need to have a negative that is as big as whatever the print size you're trying to make. But the negatives that he had were 2x3 inches or what have you, right?
Mm-hmm.
So he was making a negative, and then he made a positive glass plate to then enlarge onto a larger negative so that he could have the larger negative to make the prints out of. And they were saying in the exhibit that it was such a complicated process and so time consuming and expensive that he typically only made one print of most images. Because it was like,
think about that.
I mean, you could
one
use
print, that's it.
I mean, you could use that negative over and over again at the platinum stage, but I think at a certain point it was just like, okay, we do this, we gotta do that, we gotta do this, we gotta do that. Okay, we make a print. Okay, I don't have time to make 12 prints of that. I'm gonna get onto the next one because I've shot ten things or whatever. So it was interesting, and they had in a glass case like some of the original negatives and the interpositives, and then another internegative, and then the prints. And to see that process and just to think about what it took. I mean, nowadays, how many of us, how many listeners go out, we shoot, we come home, play with it in Lightroom, hit print, and it comes out of the Epson perfect.
Right.
You know, it's right. That's the extent of it. Yeah.
And to see how arduous that process was, that was fascinating.
Yeah, totally cool. And but it changed even within his life, right? So I, you know, that was cool. And then there was all the stuff where they were showing the films that he had made too,
right?
Which were kind of neat. And some of them were in the same place in a similar or same time as some of his iconic photographs. For example, the one you like is Wall Street. What is the one with the
right where the all the long shadows of the people walking?
Yeah.
So you've got these long horizontal shadows, but then you've got these tall verticals in the shot as well. Yeah. It's a beautiful shot.
But it's interesting because I don't think I was talking to you. I think I was talking to Ryan or Chris or Freddie. Anyway, just saying how that image, it wouldn't work nowadays because people don't all dress the same. Part of what made that image cool was that everyone was in like black and white suits.
Right.
You know, black suits,
very
white
similar
shirts.
Silhouettes across the entire
exactly.
frame.
Exactly. And it became sort of like the average everyman was right. Each person in that group. Where if you did it today, it's like some people in t-shirts, some people in a suit, some people in a dress. Like it wouldn't feel the same.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like that captured a certain period of time when people wore hats the way they do,
right. You
know, and whatever. Yeah, you know, it's when we got out to the gift shop.
Mm-hmm.
You always got to exit through the gift shop.
That's right.
You ever go to Hershey? You've probably never been to Hershey, Pennsylvania. In Hershey, Pennsylvania, you could go to the Hershey. There's like a amusement park and a Hershey museum.
Sure.
And they take you on this one tour where like, you know, you sit in these cars that drive around, you know, and like tour the whole Hershey process, and they show big giant waterfalls of chocolate, like in Willy Wonka, you know, and then it gets to the end and they let you off in a big giant room full of chocolate. It's like,
of course,
it's so slimy.
Yeah, of course.
But we got out there and there was a box of whatever it is, 25 postcards.
Mm-hmm.
And Freddie like pulls it out and he's like flipping. He goes, yeah, these are the ones these are the images that, you know, are the ones that I will remember when I leave. But to some extent, those are also the images that you've probably seen before.
Maybe in books, but not in person.
Oh, yeah, not in person. But they're the ones that you recognize as like, oh, yeah, the classic Paul Strand shot of, you know, the people in front of the verticals, you know. Overall, pretty cool. I mean, you know, it's always cool seeing the original of anything, you know. And knowing
Indeed.
That this is the original print of this thing. And, you know, this is the one that he messed around with and the one he finished. And, you know, there's something cool about that. Yeah. I don't know. You have any other thoughts on the Strand?
Not on the Strand. It was overwhelming.
Yeah.
I think.
Are you nonplussed or are you just overwhelmed?
I'm not a giant fan of him. I mean, I like some of his pieces, but I wouldn't put him in my top 10 photographers.
Okay. Yeah, that's fair. Now, after we finished that, I and some other people, we dragged you through some of the other places in the museum.
Yeah. Can I just say, I'm never going to a museum with you ever again.
Well, I wouldn't normally do it that fast, but we had like an hour to kill and I had to show you a couple things.
A couple things at complete opposite ends of each other on different floors.
Unfortunately, and that's true. But you know what? How cool was like the Chinese temple and then the little
the whole,
Japanese
like, Buddhist
temples.
Yeah. You know, big carved statues and there was this ceiling that was giant carved dragon, like a three-dimensional dragon coming out of the ceiling. It was phenomenal.
Yeah.
Phenomenal.
Yeah.
Yeah. That was incredible.
Whenever I look at museums like that, I just go, back in the days when the West could go and rape and pillage the East. Like, that's what I always like think.
See, that's no bueno.
But that's what it was, right? You know, it's like, that's where all that stuff came from. But you get to see it because of that, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, it's sort of like the Elgin marbles. Should the British Museum give them back to Greece? Probably. But you know what? If they had been in Greece all that time, they probably would have been destroyed. So isn't it good that it was stolen? You know, it's like, it's a frustrating thing. So what else did you think? Oh, wait, got to ask you, WizWit, thumbs up or thumbs down?
Oh, WizWit. You know, the Jim's was good.
Speaking of artists.
they are meat artists.
Yeah.
That was a fun experience. That was really fun doing the whole cheesesteak thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, it would have been cool to see, you know, Gino's and Pat's, just because Pat's is apparently where it began. Yeah. But you know what? It was terrific. A lot of fun. What was that street that we were on?
You know what? That is a good question. I will look it up while you're talking.
It's like one of the main streets, yeah, Freddie said.
You walked around down there a fair bit while we were sitting in the bar for a minute.
Yeah, Chris and I walked around and talked a little bit. That was a lot of fun. It was a lot of fun.
Good people.
The overwhelming thing that I came back with was there is just such amazing art out there to see.
Yeah.
And it can affect you in a variety of different ways. But standing in front of it, to your point a moment ago, standing in front of it is such a I mean, yes, it's more visceral, but it's more of an emotional experience than the best book you can possibly see it in.
True. And the best online experience and the best whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
It's different being in the presence of something that is an iconic piece of art.
Yes.
Which kind of gets back to a couple weeks ago, I guess, maybe the episode we put out when I was away. Weathersby or somebody was talking about seeing the David reproduction in Vegas.
Right.
And, you know, he didn't think much of just the statue itself. And, you know, that's a pretty good reproduction and all the rest of it. And it's like, yeah, but I wonder if it would be different if it was the real one he was looking at, you know? I mean,
the real one in Vegas?
Or if he flew over to, Florence, even more poignant.
Okay. Yeah. I don't know. I mean, seeing the real David for me wrecked me.
Right.
I mean, okay. I just sobbed.
Right.
It was so overwhelming.
Right. You know,
'cause this is something that I'd spent a lot of years in school, this and the art surrounding it, studying.
Yeah.
And then to be standing there.
Do you think that part of it is because you studied it?
I don't know because I've had similar reactions to things that I'd never seen before.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know,
did you, I mean, you saw a lot of art. Would you say you went to the Hirshhorn?
I went to the Hirshhorn.
Which is a weird museum.
It's very strange.
Big round thing. Yeah.
There were two or three pieces that I really liked.
Yeah.
In the Hirshhorn.
There can be some trippy stuff in the Hirshhorn at times.
The high point for me was the Rauschenberg that was there, obviously.
Ah, yeah, yeah, yeah.
But there again, seeing that thing in person and being literally inches away from it and seeing how, you know, how artists use brushstrokes or how they, you know, combined collage elements or how you can see their fingerprints in sculpture. You know, these things are connections, not yeah. only to the art, but to the hands that made it.
Right. Yeah. And, you know, in DC especially, there is so much art down there on the mall between the National Gallery and the four or five Smithsonian museums that are art based, and all free, right?
Okay, well that's another point entirely. Is the accessibility of art.
I mean, the Philly thing, we went on the first Sunday of the month, which allowed us to pay what we wanted. Normally it's $20. I think I put $10 a piece for Conrad and I.
Right. So that's a different experience.
Yeah, it is.
You know, you go to the Met or you go to, you know, Mocha or whatever. You're spending what, $25, $30 to get in?
Yeah. Yeah. And that's what's part of what after 9/11 they put in the what's it called? It's the metal detectors and stuff, security right. at the Smithsonian museums. It used to be that you just open the door and walk in and it's and now you have to go through this layer of security, and it somehow takes away from the just sort of walking into this beautiful place, you know, this common, like this artistic commons that they had, this mm-hmm. feeling it had, got lost a little with the security thing. But yeah, you just walk in, you know what I mean?
Yeah. And that's a very different experience.
Yeah, you know, absolutely.
It's going to the National Portrait Gallery.
Yep.
It was a half hour before they closed.
Yeah.
Are you going to go into, you know, the Met or MoCA and plop down $25 or $30 or whatever it is a half hour before it closes?
Right. Yeah.
Chances are no, because there's this mentality that you pay that much money, you got to see everything.
Yeah.
Well, but seeing everything, you end up really seeing nothing or very little.
Well, that's the problem with trying to go to any of these. Like, you know, you went to DC, you were down in the mall. You could easily have taken a week to go to those museums.
Yeah, absolutely. Especially I could spend a couple days in each one.
Yeah, exactly.
Then, okay. So one of the main reasons, I was there was to see, this woman named Michelle Fassini, who is, she's going to be an upcoming conversation. She restores paperworks. She restores works on paper. She analyzes and studies works on paper and is working on the Degas exhibit that's at the National Gallery.
She probably knows more about paper than you do.
Oh my God. She's brilliant. I mean, this she is one of the top in the world, right?
Yeah.
And got to go on the like behind the scenes tour into the restoration labs.
Cool.
Yeah. So cool.
Yeah.
Like behind, you know, fob and retina scan kind of security.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Seriously.
Yeah.
And you know, so I'm in these rooms and there are sculptures being restored. I walk in and to the right of me, there is one of Rauschenberg's black paintings just leaning against the wall. Like, oh, we're getting to that soon.
Yeah.
You know, the paint team's getting to that.
It is funny how when it comes down to it, this stuff is like, oh, it's in a box or leaning against a wall. Like we always think when we see them on the wall, like they must have these things in hermetically sealed vaults constantly. And it's like, no, they're just sitting there on a table.
They are working behind
Lots of security, of sure. Security. But like within the room, it's like,
yeah. You know? And the rooms are cleaner than your house will ever, ever be.
Yes. Yeah.
They are incredibly clean.
Well, that's the whole idea.
Vacuum
that's
systems
the game.
Everywhere.
Yeah.
And beautiful lighting. I got to go see the photo studios where the paintings and the all the 3D objects are photographed.
That's cool.
Stunning.
Yeah.
I mean, you'd lose your mind in this studio.
Well, it's the National Gallery. It's,
These
people are messing around.
You know, got to see some of the tools that she uses, some of which she made herself to do the restoration. And she showed me a piece, a pastel piece that she's currently working on where they glued down the mat. So on this particular piece, she had to remove the mat and remove all traces of adhesive and particulate matter without damaging, you know, anything below it. So she's down
there. It's like that Matisse thing I was talking about where they were pulling strand by strand off of the burlap.
That's literally it.
Yeah.
That's literally it. Yeah. And, you know, under a microscope doing this stuff, you know, fiber by fiber.
I don't have the patience for that.
Unbelievable respect for what she does. Yeah. And a knowledge so deep and so interesting and so passionate to talk about it. I can't wait to share the conversations with you. You guys are going to dig it. She's fascinating.
Now, so what is the answer? So if in DC you can see so much of this stuff all in one place, but most of those places are funded by tax dollars or giant endowments or whatever it is, like, is that the answer?
Yes.
Right. So where's that money supposed to come from?
The 1% that are paying less than the rest of us.
Okay. All right.
I
tend to agree with you. I was just wondering.
Art is uplifting. Art feeds the soul. Study after study shows that being exposed to art, music, culture makes for a better human being.
Yeah.
So why should it be within the realm of the privileged?
True. Yeah.
Why shouldn't all human beings have the opportunity to be better human beings, yeah, or be enriched or be affected by art, by theater, you by know,
MoMA is paid for on Friday nights. They have a free, I think it's Uniqlo or some company pays. So it's like free Friday night. So from 4 to 8 PM on Fridays, you can go to MoMA for free. But when they do this, there is a line that starts at 2 o'clock in the afternoon that goes around the corner.
Right. Because it's one day a week.
Yep. Yeah. Yeah.
Were that every day, then yeah, that would be that way for a start because people wouldn't be used to it. But you know, there is something to be said about being able to pop into a museum and sit in front of your favorite painting and just sit there for a few minutes or go into the courtyard knowing that you're surrounded by this work and have your lunch or have a cup of tea or a cup of coffee or something. There's something to that.
And that is one of the nice things about the Met is that it is, I think, $20 or $25 suggested, but you could pay nothing. Mm-hmm. You could give them $1 and go in,
right?
Which is nice because then it makes it accessible to everyone while still trying to get the money out of the people who have the money to spend. Yeah, sure. it's an interesting question, and Washington is one of the rare places in the world where almost all of those places are free.
With very few exceptions. The museum is not free.
Right, because that's private. The spy museum
is private, right. Sure.
But all the other stuff, it's just a matter of going, you know?
Yeah. I got to tell you. So in the Rotunda, right? At the National Archives.
National Archives Rotunda. Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. So, I forgot about the archives. All right. What'd you think of that?
My head almost exploded.
It's so cool looking in and seeing, it's parchment. That's the original freaking Constitution Declaration. Well, yeah.
Yeah. You hear this very stern, because there's a lot of kids in there, right?
Yeah.
A lot of kids from schools. And you hear this very stern guard, young man, do not sit on the Declaration of Independence. And you turn around and this kid, all sheepish, you know, kind of steps, you know, sits up really quickly. Like he was leaning back against the frames that they're in.
Oh, that's funny.
Yeah. It was very funny.
Yeah. Those are pretty cool too. And think about the technology that goes into those.
Yeah. And that was the other thing of talking to Michelle about it, where, you know, it took 20 years to design the enclosures, the new enclosures that they're currently in.
Yeah.
Because the materials themselves give off pollutants that deteriorate the materials themselves.
Yes.
So first of all, you've got to machine this frame out of one solid piece of titanium. You know, that was the other thing. You see, you know, what was it, National Treasure, where they're running out of the building.
Yep.
You know, yeah, that frame is like 650 pounds.
Yeah, yeah.
You're not running anywhere with it.
Well, they unscrewed it and pulled it out before they left. But go ahead. Continue. Yeah.
Anyway, so, you know, you've got these chemical, you know, trying to render everything inert. So they're counteracting the natural pollutants that are coming off of the objects themselves.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just deep science, deep technology.
That's very much like, we have to launch this large of a rocket with this much fuel, but we need that much fuel, which means we need that much more fuel to get the fuel up into the, you know, it's like, sort of like this meta thing. Yeah.
Yeah. It's a very strange place, and I would imagine it might even be the only place like this in the world where culture and power are sort of at opposite ends but coexisting.
What do you mean by opposite ends?
Well, you're surrounded by both, and it really sort of depends on what you choose to see.
Yeah.
Do you choose to see it as a cultural town? Do you choose to see it as a power center?
But you could argue that it only has the culture because the power is there.
Sure, and vice versa.
Right, which is the only reason the stuff at Philly Museum is there is because some big philanthropist had money and gave, you know what I mean?
There's this weird sort of power culture stasis that's happening, and maybe it's the only city like that in the world. I don't know.
And the Smithsonian is also a weird thing in itself because it, I mean, yes, it's the Smithsonian Institution, but it is such an institution that it is the New York Yankees of the museum world. So it's like, it's also got its own sort of gravitational power base itself in the museum circles. You know what I mean? So it's, mm-hmm. there's all these like weird levels of stuff that goes on. It's a fascinating place. I'm glad you had a good time.
I had a terrific time.
I'm sure there'll be more about that as time goes on. Hey, yeah. we should talk about our first sponsor today.
Linda. Lovely Linda.
I thought you were gonna go like
thought I was gonna go with the .com, didn't you? Threw you a little curve. Yeah. What that was.
Linda, speaking of Linda, Linda.com is an easy and affordable way to help individuals learn. Instantly stream thousands of courses created by experts on business, software, web development, graphic design, and more. There's probably one about paper in there. Lynda.com works directly with industry experts and software companies to provide timely training. Often the same day new versions or releases hit the market, so you're always up to speed. So, hey, new Photoshop comes out, go check out Lynda. They're going to teach you how to use all the new, you know, features and whatnot, doodads that they've added in there. All the courses are produced at the highest quality, not the homemade videos on YouTube. Is this where I'm supposed to insert my, so here I am. Go up to the, courses are broken into bite-sized pieces so you can learn at your own pace and learn from start to finish, or just go in and find a quick answer. You're like, man, how do quick masks work? Or how does the, refine, you know, edges tool work? You know, go look up Refine Edges and you'll find the video and they'll explain everything to you. Tools include searchable transcripts, playlists, certificates of course completion, which you could publish to your LinkedIn profile. Great if you're a professional in the field. So, for like all like the IT kind of stuff and the computer stuff,
yep.
You know, whether you're a beginner or advanced, Lynda.com has courses for all experience levels. And you can learn while you're on the go with the Lynda.com apps for iPhone, iPad, and Android. For a one low monthly price of $25, gives you unlimited access to over 100,000 video tutorials. How do they make 100,000 videos, Jeffrey? That's insane.
They have lots of coffee.
Apparently, premium members with an annual plan can download their courses to their iPhones, iPads, or Android devices and watch them offline. So, you know, you could download, you know, something about masking to your phone and watch it on the subway. Yeah. Premium plan members can also download project files and practice along with the instructor. So if you're the kind of person who, you know, you watch somebody retouching somebody's skin and you're like, yeah, but I don't have a file that the skin looks the same as that, so I can't tell if I'm doing a good job. Well, you know what? If you're a premium member, you can go download the actual file they were working on and work along with them like Bob Ross style. Yeah. Happy little trees.
Happy little trees. Happy
and for any software you rely on, Lynda.com can help you stay current with all software updates, learn the ins and outs of your software tools to be more efficient and productive. They're just great stuff. So many people write us and call us and ask like, oh, how do I learn how to do this? Or I know how to use Lightroom, but I've never used Photoshop or I open up something up in Photoshop and I'm overwhelmed. It's like, well, you know what? You could go find some expensive course in your local town or $25. You can go on
even less if you go annually.
Yeah.
Save $50 if you do the year up front.
There you go. So like you could go learn for the price of like one community college course, you could learn for an entire year as much as you want.
Yeah. You can even gift it. You can gift memberships to people. So you could, you know,
I want a gifted membership.
You've got the holidays coming up. You know somebody that wants to expand their sort of technical skills.
I'm turning 40 in like 7-8 weeks, so you know. And we've worked out a deal with Lynda.com to provide you with a special offer and access to all the courses free for 7 days. Just visit Lynda.com/OTP. And try out Lynda for free for 7 days. Thank you to Lynda very much for supporting 5x5 and On Taking Pictures. And we're big fans of these guys, and they do a good job. And, you know, go learn something at Lynda.
Go learn. That should be their thing, right? Go learn something at Lynda.
That is actually pretty good.
TM.
You can have it. They can have it.
They can have it?
Well, okay. They can throw me a bone.
Come on now.
I want a lifetime subscription to Lynda.
I want one of those. I gave you the idea to tip it to her. I get nothing.
Damn it. How did that work? How did that happen?
Wadman.
All right. So where are we? That's the Linda. Let's see. Going back to the thing. Okay.
Did you happen to read this Post article?
Yes. A couple weeks ago, though.
Okay. So we're talking about art today. This is a big art show because of the DC thing and because art's good and you should see art and get out and look at art. So Washington Post did this article a couple weeks ago. And the title of the article is, "If you're lucky enough to earn a living from your art, you're probably white." True? Yeah. Not true.
Well, I mean, statistically, I guess it is true.
Yeah.
You know, what is it? According to their thing, 77% of working artists are white.
Yes. 77.6% are white. 7.5% are black. 3.9% Asian. 8.3% Hispanic. 2.8% other.
Interestingly enough, though, and this is where it's interesting to me. Art school graduates make up white students make up 80.1, so 81% of art school graduates, right? But they are only 77% of working artists, where black art school grads are only 4.4% of art school grads, but working artists, they make up 7.5%. So right. It's kind of interesting that black and Hispanic artists aren't graduating from art school. They're just becoming working artists some other way. But this is not surprising in the sense that this is an economic question. I think it's an economic question as much as it is a racial question. No,
sure. Right. Sure. But I would like to see other statistics from other fields, because I would imagine that
I'm sure it's the same for chefs and, you know,
maybe, yeah.
Doctors and lawyers, I'm sure
why,
it's all
why do you think that is? I mean, because
I think
does it matter? Does it matter to you? Does it matter? It's about the art, right? So I wonder why there's such a gap.
Are you asking me specifically, or are you asking?
Yes, yeah, yeah.
I think there's a gap because
minority populations are growing everywhere in the country.
Of course they are, yeah, of course.
So why such a, I mean, 80%, that 77%, well, that's still an overwhelming majority.
Look, okay. The economic question leads to a lot of this, because if Hispanic and black American populations tend to live in poorer areas, just on a statistical basis, mm-hmm. Those are also the places that don't have art programs in their schools or music programs or whatever. Okay, it is, because sure, those are the first sure. things to be cut. They're also the places where somebody says, you need to go get a job because we need money, not let's figure out what you really want to do that you'll enjoy for the rest of your life. You know, I mean, you've said it before, it's, you know, that I'm lucky and you're lucky. And so many people are so lucky that we're able to do what we do. And that's absolutely true. And part of that comes from the fact that not even that I have money that I can do anything, because I'm not like independently wealthy or anything like that. I work to make money to live, but just the idea that making money doing art is a possibility mm-hmm. was instilled, or I don't know, not instilled. It's not like my parents ever said, you know, you should become an artist to make money.
But it was an option.
They were very much against that.
It was placed as an option for you.
Yes, yes. Or rather, it wasn't a non-starter. Where I think in a lot of social groups, maybe it is. Mm-hmm. Whether for more traditional sort of like community reasons, you know, friends, you know, it's a good question, and I don't know if it answers in this. I can't remember. If I feel like being an artist in some circles is looked up on as an aspirational goal, where in others it's looked on as either a cop out or like a wussy way to go. Know what I mean?
Yeah, I do know what you mean. I had both sides of that coin. Where? My mom was, do what makes you happy. If that's, you know, you've got this, you've got great ability, go do that. My father was, artists are a dime a dozen. What are you ever going to do with that? It's a waste of your time.
Yes, but you know what he was doing money. With his time? He was out in his thing making stuff with his shop.
Right. And that's the irony of it. That you know, when he no longer, you know, worked for a living.
He became an artist.
Yeah, he was making metal sculpture out in his shop.
Right.
So very, very strange, right? Very
yeah.
Strange.
It's a tough thing to argue. Yeah. I don't know.
I mean, always wondered if I had his belief in art and support of art in his later life, in my
early life,
how would anything have been different?
You know, that's a good, I mean, okay, that's
not even financial support, just his belief and encouragement.
Sure. Yeah. I think that is a good question to the whole group, I guess, to the listeners. I mean, there's a certain level of, are you into photography? Do you enjoy taking pictures because of your mentors in your life, or in spite of the people in your life? You know what I mean?
That's a great question.
Because I feel like,
are you doing it, I can do this, screw you, or I can do this because of your encouragement? Oh, wow, that's great.
Right. And I think,
chime in.
Because I know that there are a lot of things that I do as sort of a F you, I'm going to do it anyway.
Mm-hmm.
But then there are other things that, you know, people supported me and that's why I was able to do them. You know, you kind of, right. You can kind of go both directions. And I think that is a big argument in this whole thing. So I think while the statistics in this show, what they show, like racial divide in this.
Right.
I don't think it's certainly not about ability or anything like that. I think it's more about the communities or.
So you think it's economic? It's at the root of it. This is an economic study or is highlighting economic diversity.
Economic and or cultural. Because okay. I think that there's also a sense that art, the way that traditional, say, photography or traditional painting or traditional whatever it is, most schools are teaching them sort of the European, Italian process. You know what I mean? Like that ideal, the Western art ideal.
Okay.
And if you are, you know, of African descent or Latin American descent, it's like, well, this isn't talking to me. This is talking to the crusty white guys who made these paintings 200 years ago. You know what I mean?
Right,
you know, what who's the guy who does the big giant things at the Louvre and stuff? Those like big giant, like, you know, the Liberty and all that stuff.
David?
Is that what it is? Like, you know, like the big giant, super giant paintings of like war scenes and stuff, like the French Revolution kind of stuff. Anyway, but you look at that stuff and, you know, if you're some kid who's like in America from Guatemala or Mexico, what the hell does that mean to you? You know?
Yeah. David, Napoleon crossing the Alps, that big one where he's on the horse.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. And you see what I'm saying though? That like, I think, so there's also that element, which is, you know what? This isn't for me. This is for all the white people in America, say, you know,
maybe,
I don't know.
I would like to maybe even drill it down one step further for those of you that are maybe struggling with your own photography careers, creative endeavors, whatever that means to you, and are also parents. How are you presenting that to your kids if they are if they're interested in pursuing a career in art or a career in the arts?
Man, I know so many people though who, you know, you and I sit here and say, oh, you know, if our parents only, whatever it is. But I know so many people who said the same thing as us, but now have kids and are like, I'm never going to let my kid be an artist.
Yeah.
It's funny, it goes back around, you know?
Are you encouraging? Is your struggle your own, or is your struggle indicative of a larger struggle that you don't want to subject your kids to?
Yeah.
Podcast at ontakingpictures.com.
That is a really good question. And I think that has more to do with it than, you know, it's certainly, like I said, it's not an ability thing or a whatever thing. It's like, this is cultural stuff or economic stuff. And even if it is, it's like, well, I mean, other than encouraging people who show promise coming from minorities, whatever sort of cultural or ethnic minority, other than doing that, it's like time is, it's like so many things. It's like time just has to happen. You know, things need to, the colors need to blend together more.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we need to become a more homogenous society in order for these things to become common. It's interesting. I don't know.
It is.
You know, it's like when I was out in New Mexico, you know, and it's like we were saying last week where it's some Native American woman making pottery that then gets sold in the white piece of people's gallery for $40,000. It's like, you know what? I bet you she didn't make $40,000,
right,
you know?
Right.
Like this is, it's like it becomes co-opted as a status symbol or some, in some kind of very strange version of sort of, you know, the whole like white man's burden kind of stuff, you know? It's even like when people argued about, say, Basquiat in the 80s, it's like, you know, oh, the white artistic establishment in New York City took in this black street artist.
Right. They made a poster boy kind of thing.
Right. And it's like, oh, look how good we are that we brought in this black kid. And it's like, well, this is insane. You know, like, and it felt more that it was about the art industry than it was about Basquiat in many ways, or at least from the things I've read and seen and whatever, you know?
Yeah. I mean, one of the things that, I mean, as you are well aware because of Bert and Agnes and their education, you see kids everywhere in these museums.
Yep.
And I wonder, are there future painters? Are there future sculptors? Are there future, you know, artists in this group? How is that presented? How is that?
When you were 4 years old, you weren't looking at Rauschenbergs.
No.
Bert is.
Yeah.
You know, and like, how does
and
that,
whether or not he understands it,
right? He's sublimating.
There's gotta be some, there's gotta be some sort of sublimation that's happening on some level.
Yeah.
I would think.
Yeah. There totally is. And I mean, and now that you've been there, you could see, like, if you were a little kid and that was your world.
Oh,
it's complete. Like you have no idea.
It's amazing.
It's an opportunity to get started in a very different way mentally, you know, to where it isn't a matter of, oh, we need to take the kids to the museum to see this stuff to broaden their minds. It's like their life is that such a broad area that they can go anywhere.
Right.
Is probably the argument, you know, the angle.
And I don't remember. I'm not saying that this didn't happen, but I don't remember field trips to see art. I remember field trips.
How old were you
to,
when you were like in elementary? Where were you living at, rather, when you were in elementary school?
Well, we were still in Southern California, but you know, we would go to the La Brea Tar Pits.
Sure. Yeah.
Okay, and see that part, but we wouldn't go, you know, a half a block over and see paintings.
Yeah.
I don't remember that part. Maybe it did happen, but I don't remember it that way.
Do you think that there is a do you think that there is a certain, that there are ages when things can be understood and there's ages when things can't be understood?
Absolutely.
Right.
Absolutely.
Or is that just a bias that we have?
No. It's development. Bert's,
of course, yeah. He's not going to see Rauschenberg the same way you are, but maybe he sees Rauschenberg in a way that you can't because you are older and you have all kinds of preconceived things.
That is absolutely 100% true, that he will see it differently.
Yeah. And
whether or not, and maybe there's some more sort of profound effect that he's going through, some sort of profound response, because he doesn't try to go, well, what does this mean? He just looks at it through those child's eyes of just for what it is. Either it hits him or it doesn't.
Yeah.
You know, and it's as much as I say, I try to look at things that way, either, you know, I don't want to know what sort of cultural bias they have or socioeconomic, political, what? Sure, yeah. I don't want to know any of that. I want to know, does it resonate with me or does it not?
Yeah.
You know? And I think a great example of that is Rothko. You know, you're standing in front of this 10-foot.
Because there is no structure
no.
in Rothko that is any sort of cultural bias, right?
No, there is a pure emotional response in either you respond to it one way or you respond to it another way, or you don't respond to it at all.
It's interesting. When I was at MoMA last time, I went, they have one of the big Rothkos up on the wall, and I went, and remember how you were talking how they were designed for you to get close enough to sort of like filling your,
right.
Your
kind of fills your field of view. Sure.
Right. Like, and I've never thought of looking at them that close. So I got a little closer and whatever it is. And there's a certain point where you get too close because you can't see up and down, right? You know, you're
right,
just,
right.
But I got to where I thought was about the right thing. And it was a different experience than even being 15 feet back. So it is interesting too that it's like, you know, where things are meant to be seen from says something, you know. What did you, quick aside back to the strand thing.
Yep.
All of the prints were pretty small, like 11 by 14 or
smaller. 11 by 14, probably about that size. Sure.
I understand that they're historical prints. It was the technology of the time, whatever it is. Do you think any of those pictures though, in a fantasy universe would have meant more or less to you if they were bigger or smaller? Cause there were some that were really small. Did you notice like there were some that seemed to be contact prints from the small little negatives?
Right. Right.
wouldn't have made a difference.
I don't think it would have made a difference. Okay. You know, one of the exhibits at the National Portrait Gallery, Brady's portraits of generals.
Yep, sure.
And I'm assuming that they were contact prints from glass plate. Is that fair to assume? Yep.
Yeah.
And they were pretty small, three inch by 4 inch, you know, 2 by 3, yep, something like that.
Yep.
They were pretty small. And with a large mat around them, you know, maybe a 4-inch, 5-inch mat around them, and then the frame. And I didn't feel like, oh, I wish this was a full frame image or a full, you know, a larger image. I didn't feel slighted in any way. I think the same way with Strand.
The portrait gallery has that the original photograph of Lincoln where the plate broke.
Yeah, I didn't see that.
Oh, that's cool too. Yeah. Yeah, so I think it's true that if you're lucky enough to earn a living from art, you're probably white. But I think that is a cultural thing. If, you know, if you're lucky enough to work in finance, you're probably white, or a chef, or, you know what I mean? Like, these are larger societal questions. I don't think it's specifically about art.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I think it's more about culture and poverty and economic issues than it is. Yeah, I don't know. I might be wrong, but, you know, I'm not an anthropologist. Interesting article. We'll put it in the show notes.
Quick aside, yep, was at a bookstore called Second Story Books.
Where's that?
It's near DuPont Circle.
Okay, sure. By the way,
in fact, it's right off of DuPont
Circle. South Street is the street we were on.
South Street in Philly. That's right. That's right. So right off DuPont Circle. And I sent you a picture of this first edition.
Oh, yeah.
Richard Avedon in the American West.
Yep.
Hardcover. They had a hardcover and they had paperback.
Yep.
The paperback was 100. The hardcover was 300. It was very tempting because it's going for $450 on Amazon. But I know that if I bought that, I would never take it off the shelf and I would never look at it. So that kind of defeats the purpose of, for me, I don't like to collect things just for the sake of collecting them. I like to collect them to use them and enjoy them.
Right, right.
But it was beautiful to see that book. I've never seen a copy of that book before.
Oh, really? I think I actually have a copy of that book.
Never seen it.
Do you remember months ago, you and I were talking about that Tom Waits book that was coming out with the Anton Corbijn photographs, right?
Anton Corbijn. Yeah.
So I remember we bought
two. You bought two, didn't you?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
For $199 a piece. You know what they go for on Amazon right now?
What's that?
Current price for a used one is $1,178. New ones go for $1,249.
Wow. Yeah, it's amazing.
Sell one of them and pay, like, you know, make $1,000 on it.
There was still the other one. A Picasso lithograph book there for $1,200.
Yeah.
There was a Frank Lloyd Wright monograph. Oh my God, Bill. Multi-volume Frank Lloyd Wright monograph, $6,000. I think it was 12 volumes.
Hardcover. People pay a lot of money for these books.
Excuse me.
It's kind of crazy.
Yeah.
Hey, by the way, I went to Photo Plus last week.
Yeah.
How was it? Chris Gibbs. It was, you know, it was fine, you know, selling gear. There was nothing new there that was like, ooh, wow, look at the new exciting thing. But I guess that's the problem with a lot of that stuff. But right. I went and saw Art Schreiber talk, give a talk. And there were a couple of really interesting things in there. Number one, he says that Dan Winters apparently delivers one image. So if he's hired to go shoot somebody, he delivers one picture.
Here it is.
Yeah. Here's your portrait of Tom Hanks.
Do we have a choice? Use it or don't.
Yeah. That's ballsy. That's like,
that's your choice.
Who's the guy who designed the Next logo?
Oh,
he did the same thing, right? Where he was just you pay me like, $250,000. I design it. You use it or you don't. You pay me $250,000.
Now it's going to bug me.
Italian guy?
Yeah, Paul Rand.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. It was just okay. Yeah, it was Paul Rand.
Yeah,
Rand. Who's the weird Italian designer guy, like the modernist guy?
The one that just passed away.
Yeah,
Massimo Vignelli.
Thank you, thank you. That's the name I was looking for. Anyway, it was interesting. And then the other thing he said, which I found interesting, was remember last week we were talking about the how much people get paid for editorial things.
Yes.
But then we look at pictures like his and we're like, how the hell do you supposed to take these pictures on that little money? Like, you know, where they rent a studio and they do the whole thing. He mentioned in his talk that he was hired for some shoot recently and they were going to give him 15, which I hear is 15,000. And he went, and they moved the budget up to $18,000. So those guys at his level are not working at the same level. You know what I mean? Like they have a budget to work with,
right?
Which is a very different thing than taking somebody's picture for $1,000, you know, or whatever it is. So just interesting little piece of tidbit of whatever.
Can I just tell you how much I love that Winters delivers a one photo, image.
But I don't know if he always did that. Maybe he does now, you know?
Right.
Plus if he's shooting like 4x5 or whatever, you know, there was one other thing that he said that I wanted to bring up. Which now I can't remember. Oh, the other thing he said was that sometimes, like, he did a thing for Field and Stream, and he showed these pictures, and he had to fly out to Montana to shoot this guy. And the pictures were nice, but you know, like, totally doable by most of the people in the group. Like, they were really good, but they were just really, you know, simple. But he said that he ended up losing money on that one because he spent more money on travel and gear than it cost him to do it, you know? So he's also in a situation where he can, cause he's making money from doing like movie posters. He can afford to take a dive on some of the things that he wants to do editorially because you know, whatever it is. That was really interesting too. And remember, you know, he said that they had a shoot in Houston, maybe somewhere down in Texas. Let's say it's Houston for something. And the budget was X. I don't know what it was. And he said, you know, we knew that included travel and rentals and all the rest of it. So we were flying out from LA to do it. And he's like, we tried really hard to find makeup and hair people and like wardrobe people we try to find them in the town that we're going to. So we don't have to fly them in from somewhere because the budget isn't that big or whatever it is.
Right.
But like in a lot of cases, they can't. Which I found really interesting.
So what do they do? They bring them with?
So they fly them in from LA. Yeah. So, but it's really interesting. The whole, you know, yeah, there are people working.
So even at that level, there are concessions.
Yeah.
And we kind of think that, oh, you've made it. You can name your game, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And it also shows that like in some of these like mid-sized cities, there aren't people playing at the same league as that this guy needs.
Huh.
You know, in some of the more like secondary things. It was a good talk and really kind of interesting. And of course he showed off that the big Paramount 100 picture, you know, and he's talking about it, and he's like, you know, I do a whole talk just about this picture or whatever it is. Apparently he, you know, they got everyone in there and they're all talking, and he was standing next to DiCaprio because Leo's in the picture, and everyone was like moving up on a stage, and Leo was just standing there with his arms crossed, being very, you know, like DiCaprio, staring up, and he's just like, hey, Leo, you know, I'm Art, like, you know, I took your picture a few weeks ago for Hollywood Reporter, whatever it is. And apparently, like, apparently DiCaprio didn't even say anything, like, didn't even acknowledge what Art just said. And he's just like, this is epic. Like, this is monumental.
Yeah.
Like, just like staring at the thing, just like,
just overwhelmed with the
getting
moment.
This set of people in the same room was like overwhelming to Leo. And I just like, I like that idea. And so he got up there and he shot left, middle, and right, 20 to 30 shots of each one. So we took 100 pictures total in 10 minutes and everyone left.
Wow.
Which, you know, but if you think about it, that is actually, you know, if you're getting 20 pictures of each side, and these are professionals who know how to sit and turn and whatever it is, right?
Sure, sure.
And you get them in position and you take 20 pictures. Well, you know, if in a couple of them, so-and-so's leg is weird or his eyes are closed. Okay, grab his face from this one. Like, that's more than enough pictures to work with, you know, across a whole thing. Because they're so far away. It's not like they have to be perfect, every single person. Just interesting. Anyway, so Art Schreiber, so it was worth it to go see his talk.
Yeah.
Otherwise, you know.
Terrific picture of Michael Keaton. He just did. It was on the cover of
Entertainment Weekly. You mean the one where he's like up on the ledge?
No, the one with the feather, the black and white one.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Okay. But on the inside, there's a picture of Michael Keaton. He talked about this shoot on standing on the ledge of this building.
Oh, right.
It's okay. Not Michael Keaton.
It's not Michael Keaton.
Michael Keaton gets there the day. They got permits and they set up all kinds of rigging so that they can have like a harness on him so he could stand up there and be all right.
Yeah.
And Keaton gets there and he's like, I'm not going on the ledge. And he's like, well, we talked about it. We worked this. He's like, yeah, well, that's great, but I'm not going on the ledge.
Nice.
And so they shot Keaton standing on top of like an air conditioning vent thing at a similar height to the ledge. And they put one of his assistants in his clothes, shot him up there and comped it together.
Nice.
So it's Keaton's head on some other guy's body, essentially, is what that is.
Yeah.
But it's like, you know, interesting though. That, like, yeah. So even that is just like this problem solving thing of, you know, okay, shoot, you won't do what I want you to do. So,
right.
You know, anyway, it was good. Good talk. I won't ruin the whole thing like that, but, it was good. What do you think about this Tinder box of photos found?
Kind of interesting, right? I mean,
yeah,
there's,
this is cool.
Excuse me. There's this kind of renewed interest in Amelia Earhart.
Mm-hmm.
They think that they have found the wreckage of her aircraft.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Excuse me. And they're going back June next year.
Yeah. You know, yeah. They think they found this little piece and stuff. Yeah. It's interesting.
Yeah. I mean, they found the little piece, that they think was kind of a field repair, but there are satellite photos that show what they are assuming to be the fuselage of her aircraft
underwater.
So they're going in June to mount an expedition to see if that's in fact the case. But this thing is this box of photographs, that were found, of this Gardner Island, which is now, what's the name of it? Nicomaroro.
Yeah. Okay. So the 15 months after her disappearance, there were pictures of this island. And so what do they think? They can see something on the island, or they just think that it's interesting that somebody was shooting there?
I think it was interesting that they were shooting there.
You think these people would have tried to, you know, airplanes are flying
around. For decades,
around.
Explorers have circled uninhabited Nicomaroro Island, a 5-mile-long atoll in the Western Pacific, as a possible landing spot for Earhart. They said they will return to the atoll in 2015 to investigate a sonar anomaly 600 feet off the west end, which they believe could be Earhart's plane.
If they, okay, let's say they find this. Is that ruin a mystery for you, or do you like knowing, or do you like not knowing?
I don't care one way or the other.
Okay, man, she was a beautiful woman though. There was a movie I watched, man, where was that movie? It was on a vacation somewhere. It was on TV talking. It was all interviews with all these like early aviators, and all, they were all old women by the time. It was like in the 1980s, this documentary was made. And there was this one really sort of gruff woman who was a pilot at the time and very famous, whatever it is, but she never got the same chances and stuff as Amelia Earhart, partially arguing that it's because Amelia Earhart's husband, who was sort of like her PR guy, who sort of pushed her up to the press, because at the time it was all about, like, you know, getting press about stuff and putting on fantastical whatevers, you know. So it was an interesting way of looking at it. Like, you know, yes, she was an excellent pilot, but it was also, she got a leg up because she was, you know, beautiful as well. So it kind of fit both angles, you know?
So there was a PR angle.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, which is interesting, but stuff you don't think about now, you know? Yeah.
Hey, we got a brand new, what do you call it?
I think the word is sponsor.
That's the one.
Yeah.
Sponsor. Brand new sponsor.
We like these guys. Animoto is the new company.
We were just talking about this offline. Do you remember when this stuff was ridiculously difficult?
Yes.
Yes. Like where it was pull your hair out difficult to make any sort of video for the web.
Oh, yeah.
You know?
Next to impossible, especially like these kinds of things where you just, okay, we're going to throw in some images and we want to move them around. And, oh, we got to find some music to put underneath it.
Never happened.
Oh, man. Like, and so, okay, so Animoto, these people, it's Animoto is the easiest way to create and share high quality videos. You can use your photos, you can use video clips, even directly from your mobile device. So like, you take some photos of your kids and some video, whatever it is, upload them to Animoto, and Animoto will make a video that you can use for just about any occasion. So yep. Personal stuff, you got, you know, your kids' photos, a friend's wedding, holiday pictures or whatever it is, or if you're in a business to promote your new products or services, that kind of thing.
Yep. Made one this morning with some family photos. Just, it took me all of about 3 minutes. In fact, it took longer to upload them than it did for Animoto
to make the video,
to make this cool looking, like super 8 looking vintagey kind of film clip, including music.
Imagine the back end they have making that happen.
Crazy.
Like the engine. Yeah.
Yeah.
And they've got a wide range of professionally designed video styles to suit different uses and give your videos a polished look. So, like Jeffrey's saying, you have one that is like oldie timey pictures or whatever it is. They've got that. If you need it to look classy and cool for like a modern wedding, they've got that. They got a large library of commercially licensed music. And I'll tell you, when I first saw this, that was the one that made me go, oh God, thank God.
Yeah.
Because finding music that you can use in a video for anything online, next to impossible. I mean, there's stuff out there, but it's so hard to find and search for it. Like, they have an entire library of licensed music just for you. So it's hassle-free to incorporate songs in your videos without worrying about usage rights, and we all don't want to get sued.
Yeah. Okay, here's one more thing about music.
Yeah.
You can have it automatically set the length of your video to the song.
Yeah.
So you've uploaded all your clips and your photographs. You can choose to do it manually, or you can say, you know what? I've got, 75 pictures and I've got a 5-minute song. You figure it out. Just make it match.
Yeah. Be a computer for me. Compute something.
Yeah.
I think the word you were looking for though is automagically.
That's the one. Automagically. Yeah. You can change styles, so you don't have to remake. Like, if I didn't like the oldie timey style, if I wanted to do, I don't know,
swap out the theme.
Yeah. Documentary style. Just boom, you're done.
Yeah. And the videos are hosted up in the cloud, so you don't have to worry about where to store them or how people can view them. You know, it's really great. So like, I look at this from our listeners' point of view, from a lot of photographers, especially the people who are doing events and that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
You could take the photos, you can make a video as like a value add for the project and say, yeah, we're going to get all these things, but we're also going to give you this video made from the images and some of the video with music and everything like that, that an extra thing for your wedding or your corporate party or whatever it is, you know? So they help you edit the videos and the photos into a professional quality video you can be proud of and you can share with clients. They got Animoto has a free trial of their pro product, so it's risk-free to try all this stuff. 1080p video HD downloads, commercially licensed music, video styles co-designed with photographers are some of the most awesome features that come with Animoto Pro. And they increase sales by showing clients their photos within a video. So, you know, it's all about evoking emotion, right?
Yeah, it is pretty cool.
Yeah, it's really great. So market to your business in the second largest search engine in the world, which is YouTube. It's great for SEO, not to mention keeping people on your site longer. Because they, you know, it's going right on YouTube. And let's say you want to share it on YouTube, you could share it on Vimeo, anywhere else online, just a click of a button. So you guys really got to go check out Animoto. It's great. Go learn more, support the show by visiting animoto.com/pictures. That's animoto.com/pictures. And if you use the offer code pictures at checkout, you'll get 10% off a new pro annual subscription. Thank you very much for Animoto for supporting 5x5 and not taking pictures.
Yeah, this is cool stuff. Like you mentioned, you mentioned event.
Yeah.
You could shoot or have your second shooter shoot and have a cool like video slideshow kind of thing on a kiosk before the reception.
Yeah. Yes.
To give people kind of a quick preview of what they can see.
And even like they were saying, even video from your phone, you know, you don't have to have a fancy video setup, you know?
I grabbed the app before the show. I haven't used it yet, but it looks pretty cool.
All right, so we're going to check it out some more as time goes on. We'll be talking about this again soon. So thank you very much, stuff. Animoto. Let's get back to the show.
All right. So last week.
Yeah.
Multiple exposure.
Some of them are really good.
Yeah, they are. Bill Memes, super cool one. With the profile and the face on portrait, you see that one?
Yep,
that's pretty cool. Can I just say, just as an aside, Millie, you just kill it every week, regardless of what you're posting. You're just killing it every week.
Oh, sure. You're going to give her all kinds of props like that, huh?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I like Juren Van Rouge or whatever his name is. Rouge.
Uh-huh.
His stuff's really, really good.
Yep.
Those are really good, too. Millie does, too. I was just giving Millie crap. I like Matheson's picture of the Japanese flags over the street.
Yes.
That's pretty cool.
He's another one that kills it every week, Matheson.
Yep.
Matheson.
What's we have some serious...
Matheson ever done?
Isn't he adminning with Baleward?
Yeah.
Okay, we've done that.
Jason, good stuff. The multiple exposure with the vinyl and the... Yep. Yeah.
It's really nice. Some
great stuff. Yeah, David Lawrence, great stuff.
Yeah.
David Gardner. A lot of the silhouette double exposures, very cool stuff.
Yeah, who's the guy who first did those? Remember those were like big last year or 2 years ago. They were, you know what I'm talking about?
I don't know, but I do know what you're talking about. I think they were black and white too, weren't they?
Yeah, or like toned.
Right.
And it was like, you know, some beautiful woman with like inside of a tree and that kind of stuff.
Bob Camp, nice.
It's a really good idea.
Yeah, so fun stuff.
So what do we got for next week?
You know, next week, partially inspired by my trip to Philly and DC. Let's just do food. Simple. What's the food that you dig? What's the food that you don't dig? I had some fantastic food over the past week.
What else did you have other than the cheesesteak and the donut?
There's this little chicken place called El Pollo Rico. It's a Peruvian chicken place, little hole in the wall, but chicken, beans, rice, plantains. Fantastic.
Wait, where was this again?
It's in Maryland, in Silver Spring, Maryland.
Okay.
Oh, and there's this other little place called the Quarry Tavern. You can get tater tots there.
You know, there's a few places in New York you can get tater tots, and it is dangerous.
Oh man!
Especially when they're cooking them in a deep fryer.
That's the thing, right? Where they're crispy, yeah. But then they're just
Tater tots in an oven are not like a tater tot in a fryer.
Yeah, no.
There's a place called Trailer Park on 23rd Street and 8th Avenue in New York.
That's a great name.
And inside it's all kitschy and like they've cut the sides off of like RVs and stuff. So like inside it feels like you're kind of outside surrounded by RVs and stuff.
Nice.
And there's all kinds of pictures of, you know, kitschy stuff of Elvis and whatever. But one of the things they do is they make beef sloppy joes and tater tots is one of their things.
Oh, man.
And they put like peppers in the sloppy joe. It's good.
Yeah. This place, it's a little dive bar down below the street. So you go down these steps and it's low ceilings, incredible burgers. They even do burgers with grilled cheese sandwiches as the bun.
Oh, that's trouble.
Yeah.
That's the kind of stuff that's going to do you in.
Yeah, with some tater tots and an ale. Oof.
Yeah.
Yes,
yeah.
Please.
Nice. We're going to try to make, you know, those sopapilla things that Heather and I had in in Santa Fe. What's it called? A recipe online. So we're going to try to make them. But we got to, you know, I was talking to Connors about it because I was like, I need to do some oil. He's like, yeah, just do it in a deep pan. It won't spit up. And I'm like, you're a master.
He's I want to go to his restaurant.
Yeah, well, next time you come.
I got to do another trip. Food.
Got it.
Hashtag food.
Good. All right. So this week's photographer of the week was sent in to us.
Okay.
By who was that? It was the a couple weeks ago. Oh, shoot. Sakasagawa, maybe? Probably.
Maybe. And Mike...
Oh, no. It was from Sakasagawa. Right. So he sent this in. Now,
Can I just say, sure. I love Mike's emails.
Oh,
I don't always respond to them, Mike, but please don't stop sending them because they are fantastic food for thought.
He loves writing the long emails.
Yeah. And they're much appreciated. So keep them coming, please. Yeah.
All right. So have you looked at these pictures this guy's done?
This is Chris Engman?
Yes. Chris Engman. Okay. So this show... apparently is called Ink on Paper, right? And so he does all kinds of stuff where he's talking about and then here go to the second link from his gallery and you can click through these images And there, it's like, go to number, like, let's say go to number 12. So.
Okay. So it's kind of edge on. It looks
yeah,
like
he
we're
shot
looking
it at a perspective. And then it's also like in a, like you have to, I think he shot it in perspective and it's on the wall crooked, but that, you know what I mean? So it's like both the frame and the image are skewed.
Yeah. I don't. So are we looking at a flat print?
Yes.
We're looking perpendicular to the print, which yes. has been shot at this very sharp, sharp angle.
Right.
Okay. Yeah. Okay.
And then
it's playing with my eyes.
Well, that's the thing, right? And go to number 18. And there's this one inverse negative where he's built this thing to create black with a white box in the center. But then on the other side, look, he's taped it out the same
thing. Oh, yeah.
So then it's white with a black in the center. So he's building these structures in order to create shadows that are structural. Go to number 21. He takes a pile of dirt and moves it so that the background is different. But the dirt pile is the same.
But the dirt, and this is not Photoshop.
No, I don't think so. I think he actually moves this stuff. There's another wow. one. There's another one. Number 20 is the same thing where it's boxes. It's called location relocation. So he has all
wow,
these like,
oh, that's kind of cool. So he's, this is photography. This is art. This is.
Yeah. They're almost like art installations that are also photographed. There's also go to number 24 inversion where it's concrete blocks like cinder blocks in a certain configuration, but then slid out like
he's mirrored image them, flip them horizontally in the same location. Oh, that's freaky cool.
Right. Now, so, yeah,
that's freaky cool. I love that.
See, these are pretty cool, right? Go to number 27 and he put up mirrors, I think. No, those are photographs.
No, these are flats.
Yes. But look, it's like it's inside of itself again, like inside the flat is also a picture of the flat turned the other way further back.
Right.
So he went there, shot that. Got it printed.
Went back.
Put it forward to the camera.
Wow.
And then shot that. Now, okay. So the reason I bring this up is that in Chris's, in Mike's email, he was arguing that he said, this is probably stuff, you guys will probably hate this artist statement that he wrote because there's this artist statement, which says, photographs are inherently a false mediating and distancing way to experience the world. What is preserved is a very limited, only one view from one point. The third dimension of space absent, sounds, smells, and other contacts removed, all but perhaps the 125th of a second gone. This might sound like an indictment, but it isn't. It is precisely these qualities of photography that are compelling to me, the paradox of seeming to have but not actually having. And it goes on for four more paragraphs.
Right, right.
To me, yeah, this artist statement to me reads as just your usual art school pretense artist statement and wholly to me unnecessary. I think the work stands well enough on its own without that. And I guess that's my question to you.
Paragraph 4 yep. in this statement.
Yep.
Is I don't say necessary, but
all right,
I like what it's saying. We are used to looking through the surface of photographic prints at the illusion of space they create. In this case, the viewer is doing exactly that, and to a heightened degree, while simultaneously looking at an image of a thing that is doing something very different. The paper within the paper is asserting itself as an object on its own. This is an image that does something images do not usually do. It acknowledges explicitly that it is an image.
Yeah, but see, to me, that doesn't... I think these things are cooler if you don't read that and you just look at them and go, oh, that's a cool idea. Like, that's neat. Like, oh, look what he did. He embedded this inside of that and shot this. And, oh, look, he inverted them and moved
them.
Like, basically, the reaction that you just had when we were flipping through them is a better reaction to me than once I read that, then it's like, okay, he's trying so hard to explain this, but it doesn't need to be explained. Explaining it takes away from it. to me.
For you. Yeah.
For me, it
for
does.
For other people, they may go, oh.
Yes.
Oh, okay. Now I see what's going on.
Right. And that's my question. That's the reason I threw them in here.
I don't think this is as art school pretensy, to borrow that term, as
some things.
As some things, or as you are making it out to be.
Yeah, but I don't think that it's necessary. I think this work stands on its own. And shouldn't work stand on its own, ideally?
Some.
Do you think this work is made better from reading that? By the way, go to number 9. Where he swapped out one rock just right of center.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, actually, he rotated a lot of things. He rotated some other rocks, too.
Yeah. This is not just swapped.
Yeah. There's a few. But, like, you look at them quick, and it's, yeah, because there's one down the bottom that's tipped. Oh, I'm sorry.
I don't know. I don't think this is, I wouldn't say this is bad if I'm making some sort of qualitative, you know, the judgment writing on it.
No, it's not bad. It's just, what does it add?
Well, for you, not a lot, but for other people, this might provide the context that they need to go back and go, oh, okay, I see what's going on here. I appreciate this.
Here's a question for you. If the artist was thinking should an artist be able to write the artist statement before the work is done? See what I'm saying? Like, should he have it in his head what he wants at the end and sort of have planned it for the artist statement to really mean something? Or is it the kind of thing you can backfill after the fact?
I think that there are two different ways of looking at that. I think that you can, pardon me, I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. I think that you can do it beforehand because you've got an idea for a body of work that wants to follow a certain thought process.
Right.
But I think for a lot of people, including probably a lot of listeners of this show, a style, a theme, a body of work emerges in hindsight.
Yep.
And maybe then the statement regarding the work, it's not an afterthought, but it comes after the work has been created. And yep. I don't think there's any less validity or more validity doing it one way or another. I think it really depends on how you approach the work.
Yeah. It's fascinating to me. I went back 10. And forth with him. Number 10. You like number 10?
Relocation.
Oh, yeah, he's like took that chunk of sand and moved it somewhere else.
Yes.
This guy's got some serious OCD issues, yeah, I think.
Yeah. Really fascinating work.
It's cool stuff. So everyone go check this out. Chris Engman. We'll put the links in the show notes. And I think he's fun and something different and something modern.
Very nice. Yeah, very good stuff.
Good topic for discussion.
Yep, absolutely.
All right. You got anything else?
I think I'm good.
Okay. How do people get a hold of us?
podcast@ontakingpictures.com. Yeah. That's one way. You could also leave a voicemail like Tom from Maine, Tom from Michigan. I'm sorry, Tom. 347-687-9411. 347-687-9411.
We like those voicemails.
The voicemails are fun.
There is a limit though. What is it? 90 seconds or 2 minutes?
Oh, I don't know. Is there?
Yeah. Cause Tom from Michigan hit the limit.
Oh,
back. He was telling us a story and then, you know,
if you hit the limit at 90 seconds, then call back and keep going. Yeah. You know, you want to leave serialized versions? Go ahead. Yeah. Bill tweets at Bill Wadman. I tweet at Jeffrey Sidoris. And if it's at all possible, go see DC. I can't wait to go back.
It's a good place. In fact, we're making plans to go down there for the, for the Christmas holiday. So we're going to go,
Yep. One other thing. Chris Connors wrote something very nice on the group, and I wonder if I could I read that? Would that be okay?
Sure, I think that's fine.
Let's see, where is it? Now I need to find it.
Was it in the discussion section?
Talk amongst yourselves. here it is. Okay. Chris Connors, if you've ever considered organizing an OTP meetup in your area, all caps, do it. This group is amazing, and we all have something in common beyond just the fact that we like to take pictures. There's something about OTP that brought us here in the first place, and when you hang out in person with these people, you really feel it. Yesterday was the third. one that I participated in, and I now feel like true friends with a handful of people I met just about a year ago. You don't need to be a great photographer. You don't need to be a great host. Just pick a date, pick a venue, and put it out there. You'll have a great time, maybe learn something, and if you're really lucky, maybe make some new friends. Just do it. That is, I got a little,
Got a little verklempt.
Yeah, yeah. So thank you, Chris. But, and it was such a pleasure meeting all of you guys.
I completely agree. But to be fair, you cried a lot of things.
I do. I do.
All right, let's wrap this up. You got anything else?
No, I think that's it. Thank you for listening. I'm sorry about my voice. I'll be back in better form next week, I hope.
I think you'll be fine. All right, we'll talk to you later.
Thanks for listening.
This way, say what you wanna say.